Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out on a stormy, cold, and icy night. Please take care when you leave this place and going home. We really appreciate your support of our bookstore and our author events, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores. It is a great pleasure to introduce Pulitzer Prize finalist and National Book Critics Circle Award-winning author and to his old stomping grounds, Ted Conover, who will talk about his new book, The Roots of Man, How Roads Are Changing the World and the Way We Live Today. In this book, Ted has explored six of the world's key byways from Peru to East Africa to China and more, and they're all using his immense talent and insight on how the roads from the time of ancient Rome to today have played a crucial role in human life. Ted Conover is the author of several books that we have here today, including the award-winning New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing, and Rolling Nowhere, Riding the Rails with America's Hobos. His writing has appeared in many magazines, and he's received a lot of awards. And he lives in New York now, but please welcome him back to Denver, Ted Conover.
Well, I better not be speechless, but I am grateful. I thought I've got to get up really early this morning. I was in San Francisco, so that at least I'll be here for the dozen people who make it through the storm. And instead, look, I'm really just quite delighted. As my father put it, the roots of man are icy tonight, but... But here you all are, and I think I know at least half of the people in this room, which is just a fantastic validation. Among them, I should say, are several of my former teachers. I haven't been able to go through all the faces yet, but I know you're out there, and I was... last night, I gave a reading in San Francisco, and two of my classmates from Manual High School were there. One, Jay Leibold, is the friend I dedicated this book to. He's read all my books for me. he and I co-edited the Manual High School newspaper back in the day, and we were friends with a guy named Scott Langford, who's now a professor of English in San Francisco, and he was saying, so which teacher really did you learn to write from? Who was that? And we traded notes, and he was actually able to name one or two, and I felt more that I'd soaked up a lot from various places, and I still try to do that, actually, but we are all taught and we are enabled by our teachers. And so especially if you're a teacher, thanks. Thanks for coming. And there's one other thing before I forget. My father and Jacqueline Wonder and my sister, Beth Conover, and her husband, Ken, have arranged for a reception afterwards. Some of you may have heard of this happening, but you all are invited. Everybody, please stick around. There'll be things to drink and eat kind of over on that side of the room. So we'd love to spend some time with all of you when I get done yakking. And let me also give a special thanks to my dad and Beth for rallying the troops. One could not imagine a more supportive family, and that has made it easy for me to take some of these trips so far away from home for such long stretches of time. Some of my first trips by myself were in Denver. In fact, the first ones that left a big impression on me were the Rocky Mountain News delivery route I had on either side of 6th Avenue. It was an upscale route. It was High Street, Ray, Circle Drive. But it was winter, and it was dark when I headed out there and with my dog. But that was actually a big part of the appeal, because I could go somewhere under my own power. Right after that, one of my best friends from the time, Lane Summer, and I see some of Lane's people here. We took a bicycle ride at age 15 by ourselves through New England, and came back in one piece, and I don't know. It all sort of helped with a sense that you can go out there, and if you are prepared and you are careful and you're sober, you have a good chance of, well, and a little lucky, you have a good chance of coming back. Another friend and I rode our bicycles all the way across the country when we got into college on the East Coast. And somehow these all added up not only to a delight at travel, but an interest in it. And I think it was Manuel in particular that added to that love of adventure, an interest in other people besides myself, which is a pretty important ingredient, I think, if you're going to write more than one book anyway. So my first book grew out of a research for an anthropology thesis about railroad hobos. While and Denver was right in the middle of it. I got arrested here for the first time walking across a 15th Street viaduct, I think it was, by a policeman who... oh, I was naive. He didn't like the looks of me, and the president was supposed to come to town. They wanted to get people off that bridge, and he used bad words to get me off the bridge, and I felt like saying, "I was a Denver Post Citizen of the Week, sir." Then I probably would have gotten beaten up, but instead I was just detained briefly. Went on to California, where I noticed that a lot of the people riding the rails were Mexicans, were undocumented Mexicans, and that my Denver Public Schools Spanish, augmented by an experience or two overseas. Thank you, Sam Butler. I see you over there. I had enough Spanish to talk to these guys, and they would, to my surprise, speak to me. And that made me think, wow, there's a book to be written about the real modern-day hobos, which is recent immigrants from Mexico. And in the course of writing those two books, I understood how helpful travel is to structuring a story, to putting together a narrative. And I became very fond of that form. My next two books were not at all like that. The third book about Aspen was sort of a way... I was vexed by a writer I knew in New York. He's now the editor of the New Yorker magazine. And at a party, David Remnick introduced me as a writer who makes his living sleeping on the ground. This is after my first two books. And I thought, that's like, you know, being Gilligan or something and never being able to get another role. How long could I continue, or was I interested in doing that? So I thought going to Aspen would be a way to see if this participatory research style works in the other direction. And it kind of did. I had a very different kind of experience with that book and through jobs at Mellow Yellow Taxi and the Aspen Times, and for a caterer and various other things. And I re-met a woman I had dated in graduate school in England, who eventually led me to conclude I should move to New York. And so that's where I wrote White Out, and where I read in the papers about the record numbers of people going to prison and thought, how could you write a good book about prison? All the best ones are by prisoners. They truly are. Jack Henry Abbott and Mumia Abu-Jamal and George Jackson, Eldridge Cleaver. I mean, those, the best books are prisoners. I couldn't think of a crime. But I tried. I did. But the key would be to get out when I wanted to. And that was the sticking point. And then I thought, I'm always interested in stereotypes. And there's a big prison stereotype, as you know, in the form of prison guards or correction officers. And I was interested in that, and I wondered how true it was. And the more I looked into it, the more I thought that they know prison in an intimate way also. They get to go home at the end of the day, but they spend, as some of them said, 20 year sentence in 40 hour installments. So they speak the same language as prisoners at a urban prison like Sing Sing. It's in Westchester County. It used to be in the country, but it's a place where a lot of the officers grew up in New York City and went to school with the prisoners. So they know them very well. And if a prisoner appeared in the one of my colleagues knew him, he'd have to tell the sergeant about that, and the sergeant would say, well, will you be able to treat him fairly? And the answer is usually yes, and everything's okay. But by hanging, I thought if I could be in that situation, I might learn some important things. It's really my only undercover book. I hope I don't do another one soon. That's a really, really hard thing to do, not just to maintain secrecy, but to partition your life in the way you have to when you can't tell your closest friends what's going on with you. And not only that, it's really stressful what's going on with you. And you're changing in ways you can't quite describe. And you kind of understand the basis of all these movies about undercover narcotics agents who, you know, they get divorced, they get addicted to drugs, they neglect their animal, whatever. They fall to pieces. And and I probably would have too if I didn't have an amazing wife. And then actually I had a 1 month old daughter as well the month I started that job. So I hoped to be done in about 3 months. Instead, my agent, whenever I told her how it was going, said, well, you're getting there. And but she didn't see that I had a book even after 4 or 5 months, and nor did I. I was sad to admit. And so I had to keep going 9 months, 10 months. And then Christmas comes into view. And I imagine that with an emotional occasion like Christmas or the New Year, there might be a conclusion to my experience that made sense. And by that time, too, I'd gotten to know people in the depth I had to write a book about the experience. And to feel like a guard, which I did. And I still say we when I talk about COs. Because I related to them quite a bit, probably too much. there was a night when I got the dream assignment of prison, which was transportation detail. It involved taking a prisoner out on the road. This particular prisoner had been getting in fights and needed to be transferred. And another officer and I put him in a van and drove him upstate on the New York State Thruway. And he didn't want to talk to me. I always wanted to talk to prisoners because I was doing research, and I'm like that anyway. But he didn't want to talk to me because I was a correction officer. But when we were sitting there eating our hamburgers at the rest stop, he did start to talk, and he was fascinated by the trucks, the long-distance truckers, and said, "You know, CO, when I get out of here, when I finish my bid, that's what I want to do. I want to drive one of them things." And I felt I knew what he was talking about, because that was my idea too. Because prison is the opposite of travel. It's about moving almost not at all. And so I was ready to travel, ready to move. And it had been about a year after New Jack came out that a phone call I'd been waiting for my whole life arrived. It was National Geographic magazine, which I had thought right after college would be the perfect place for me. I just thought that's they don't know how much they need me, and I worked to convince them of that for a long, much too long. I held on to that dream, and the closest I got was a lunch with, it turned out, 5 editors. I thought it would just be with one. He invited me into town, paid for my transportation, fancy restaurant. I'm dressed up something like this. And it's all men in their dark suits. This is back in the day. And at the lunch, I had my first martini ever. And my second as well, because that's what they were doing. And around dessert time, they kind of remembered I was there and asked sort of in passing what my ideas were, and didn't seem at all disappointed to note they had done some version of each of them already. And when you've been publishing for 80 years or whatever, what have you not written about? But they weren't interested. It's probably a good thing. It set me off on my own as a sort of person, as an independent person who had to cook up ideas. And they were calling now because of coyotes, because of my book about Mexican immigration. And the idea that they had for me was to write about a new road that would connect the east and west coasts of South America. Now, there's more than one of these roads about to be completed. They all go through Brazil, and then various ones go through Chile, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, countries that have ports on the Pacific, which Brazil really wants so that it can export soybeans and beef and such to Asia. So these roads over the years, if you look at a series of maps, you can almost, it's almost like nerves reaching out for their counterpart coming in from the other coast. All these routes reaching for each other. Some of them actually connect now, but none in a way that can carry a truck year round through the rainy season. So I thought, that's a terrible, I'm happy she's called, but what a terrible idea. Who wants to write about infrastructure? I'm not an engineer. I'm not sure what I am, but I'm not interested in construction. I'm interested in people. And, but I spent a couple days thinking, and I thought, well, you could write about roads by writing about people and the people they affect, the people on them, the people near them, the people they bring into contact with each other. And I approached the project that way. The best moment was when they asked what my budget for a driver would be. And no one had ever even asked if I wanted a driver before. And I pictured those documentaries where the, you know, the big National Geographic sedan with the flags flapping off the front fenders comes into town, and everybody drops what they're doing to come talk to them. And I thought, that's really not my approach, and I hope they like my approach, because I don't like that way myself. And I so I rode on trucks and in vans. I rode on fuel tanks that go from Cusco down into the rainforest. They carry fuel because there's no oil down there, and there's lots of machinery. There's generators that need to run, and then they carry people on top, so it's like a flammable bus that goes down the most dangerous road you've ever seen. And but I thought, as I often do, the odds of this particular one exploding are fairly small, and so far it's working out. And when it came time, well, I wrote the article. I went back to New York. A writer friend of mine observed that I'd written many stories about roads, and I was surprised by that. I really had no idea that I had, and he remembered one I'd written for The New Yorker about East African truckers and AIDS, and one about the Texas-Mexico border. And we got to talking, and that's kind of where the idea was born, the idea of a book that would be about specific roads, but it would also be more than the sum of its parts, because there, if you look at several examples of the same thing, you can draw some larger conclusions about the power of this particular artifact. This is the largest thing humans have built on Earth, is the system of roads. They are so prevalent in the continental United States that they cover 1.5% of the surface area. It's easy to believe in New York City, you'd think it's a lot more than that, but go heck to Lyman or something, and you can't believe that figure. That's a huge amount of our soil that doesn't receive rain because there's pavement on it. You know, it seems as a culture we're kind of trying to put the brakes on roads. And let me just comment right here. I spent a whole book trying not to use phrases like put the brakes on or hit a bump in the road or took a wrong turn, because the language of roads permeates how we describe our enterprises. It's almost impossible not to use a road metaphor if you talk for very long. I'll green light that project. Okay, I put them all together, and I put them all together in the epilogue. I isolated them in a few paragraphs, but there's a lot you can get at through roads. And what I got at, I hope, in this book is, first of all, in Peru, the tension between development and the environment, which is a very big deal. The rainforest, you know, as much as people get bored by that phrase, the rainforest, and every, you know, all the expectations of what to do that go with that. I mean, the rainforest is amazing because that's where rubber that began the automotive revolution was, of course, first cultivated. And annual burnings of the rainforest contribute 20% of the carbon in the atmosphere right now. So the road going through there is going to make that worse. On the other hand, everybody in Peru, at least, is convinced that the road will help them survive. It will increase their prosperity. The people you meet down in the rainforest are cutting wood, mostly. They cut mahogany, especially. Peru has some really nice forest. The world wants mahogany, and they feel that roads will help them get it out. And I'm sure they're right. One thing I did with my National Geographic money was fly over the border between Brazil and Peru with a photographer, and Brazil's road, which comes right up to the border, is deforested on either side for about 20 miles. It's a striking sight. You're in the middle of this ocean of trees, and then alongside the road, you can just see there it all goes. And then you get to Peru, and it's just a muddy track, and there's no deforestation at all. But there's about to be a lot more. And how do you say maybe this isn't a great idea? To answer this question, I found an anthropologist in Puerto Maldonado, which is a big tropical province in Peru's Amazon. And I said, so what's going to happen? And he knew exactly. He said, you know, gas stations will be the gas station for Brazil. There'll be lots of development along the road. There'll be sex workers more and more because those Brazilian drivers will have money. There'll be pollution. There'll be lots of, air pollution and all the other pollution that pavement and runoff brings to a place. He said it will harm the indigenous people who many of whom still live in Peru with very little contact with the outside world. He knew, and I said, so how do you tell people? And he said, I can't tell people. He said, I'd be drummed out of town. I said, come on. And 6 months later, there was in fact a riot in this town in which the headquarters of four NGOs that promote environmental agendas were set on fire. People get so angry at any effort to slow development down there because they're very poor. And that is what they see will bring them the prosperity that places like us enjoy. So, and it was true all over the world. The people in these remote places want the road, and it's really hard to tell them they should not feel that way. The next chapter is about isolation versus connection. It's about a valley in Ladakh. That's the Tibetan Buddhist part of Kashmir, real close to Pakistan to the north and China a little bit to the east. The Indian Army is building a road there to supply its troops on the border with Pakistan. There are tens of thousands of these troops. When the snow comes there, the passes all close. So these valleys are cut off 8 months a year. Army flies food in at a cost of millions of dollars. And the people in these little valleys have to wait for things like the freezing of the river that connects this one valley, Zanskar, to the Indus River in the main city of Ladakh, which is called Leh. And I thought it would be really interesting to walk on that road with people who really, the ice road that is, with people who care about it, which is teenagers who use it to get to boarding school when they're about 13. They want to continue their education. They've got to leave. And that's how they go. And one of these teenagers was the son of my translator, and they had me over to dinner. It's so remote there. They're just getting cell service now. It's the back of beyond. It was an earthen house, three stories tall. The first story is just for animals like yaks in the winter when it gets so cold. It protects them from predators and freezing. The next floor is where almost everybody lives. You walk up this it's like a hobbit tunnel to get to the second floor, and it's lit by lamps at night. They've turned off the generator at about 5 p.m. And I walked into the cave where one of the young sons of my translator lives. And there on the wall is the exact poster of Avril Lavigne, the pop singer that my daughter has on her wall in New York City. And my jaw dropped. And he said, "You've heard of Avril Lavigne?" And I said, "Heard of Avril Lavigne? I hope to go to an Avril Lavigne concert with my daughter." And then it was his turn to be amazed that someone might actually be in the same room with Avril Lavigne. And right then, you understand why young people want to leave small places everywhere. They want to come see Avril Lavigne. And there's no way you can tell them She's not that great. They're not interested. Don't want to know. I'll get back to that topic of how of our the power of our popular culture and how maybe it holds a solution or two to some of these problems. But quickly, I'll just give you an overview. The next chapter, I revisit those drivers in Kenya who I traveled with for the New Yorker in the early 90s. About half of the dozen men are still alive. Most of the rest have probably died of AIDS. No one's sure because there are not autopsies routinely given. In fact, HIV tests are only given if you go to the hospital for some reason. And then they'll tell your employer the result, but they won't tell you. So there's all kinds of denial still of AIDS going on over there, even though the place has been just ravaged by the epidemic. This whole area around the hospital that I remembered from my earlier trip, it was like full of candy stores and groceries and stuff. It's now all coffin makers, and half the coffins are about 2 feet tall, which is one of the saddest things you'll ever see. And but my driver, miraculously, the guy I'd gotten to know really well on the first trip, he was an assistant then, and he's been promoted to a senior driver. He's making enough money that he now has a second wife and extra children. They live on his new route, which goes to Kampala, Uganda, and back. He makes this trip several times. Well, three times, maybe a month. So I took a trip with him to write about how everything has changed because of that epidemic. And the road in this case carries wonders of the developed world. On my original trip, we carried paint, corrugated roofing, bottles for the brewery in Kigali, Rwanda, and medicine from a missionary group in the southern United States. We carried all these things from Mombasa into Central Africa. And then the same road carries germs in the other direction. So the more I thought about this, the clearer it became that every road is an intention. We build them for a reason. We want to connect. We have a very often a specific agenda for connecting. It often has to do with economic development, but not always. And then there's always an unintended consequence. There's the destruction of the rainforest, the spreading of disease, the loss of religious fervor among younger people in Ladakh. And then it gets really complicated when you start looking at roads and war. I don't need to tell you that most soldiers actively at work these days are involved in occupations. Ours are in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have armies that no one can keep out, but we cannot keep them safe on roads. That's where we're vulnerable. The roads are too long to defend. The technology behind IEDs is it ranges from sophisticated, like you see in the Hurt Locker, where there's remote control bombs. I just talked to a veteran in Los Angeles last week who told me that was always the scariest part of his whole tour through Iraq, was when they had to go out in a convoy. He said you just assume somebody's going to get hurt, but you don't know which truck's going to be over the bomb when somebody pushes a button. Well, there's an article in today's paper that in Afghanistan, they've boiled the ingredient. They don't even use the electronics that we have developed means to detect. They now are just using diesel fuel and fertilizer, and there's no remote control involved at all, which makes them even harder to find, and they're more lethal than they've ever been. So it's a huge problem. We repaved the route between Kandahar and Kabul at a cost of over $200 million about 5 years ago. And on the day the road was dedicated, all the dignitaries flew in because the road was too dangerous to drive. Well, my wife will not let me go to Afghanistan or Iraq, but she said I could go to the West Bank, and I thought that's the kind of war. It's certainly a place where an unwelcome military controls people unfriendly to it. It's a really tricky place to write about because the passions are so high. Globally, the passions are high about that place, and especially where I live in New York, they are. But I thought the way to do this is to spend time first with soldiers, and I got permission from the Israeli Defense Forces to move in with a company of soldiers north of Ramallah on a base they keep there, from which they patrol roads and try to catch bombers. The near completion of the security fence, that wall, has reduce the number of bombs that get found now, but there are tons of checkpoints all over the West Bank, and it actually reminded me less of Iraq or Afghanistan than Sing Sing, where a small number of officers controlled prisoners by restricting their movement to very short distances. So to get from the front gate of the prison to the housing block where I worked, I had to go through 12 gates. And to get from his cell to the mess hall, an inmate has to go through about four of them. And so just two or three officers can move a group of 60 inmates through the prison one little piece at a time. And something similar goes on in the West Bank. The difference being that, and the thing that makes it harder for those soldiers, is at least I knew the people I was controlling this way had all done something bad. They were criminals. Many had committed murder. But in the West Bank, that's not true. Those people aren't bad at all. There's a few who will resort to violence and want to blow things up, but they're such a tiny minority, and soldiers, like our soldiers, have to treat everybody like they could be very bad, and it makes the Palestinians so angry and so I traveled with a student after I was done with the soldiers. 3 weeks later, I changed sides, and a student said, you should ask people here when they travel, how do they feel on these roads? He says, I feel terrible. Everybody makes me feel like I'm a criminal, like I'm a bad person, and I hate traveling here. I don't want to travel at all. We visited his father, who's the president of Hebron University, it turns out, who has a PhD in chemistry from the University of Florida at Gainesville. A son, the way I met this family is another son is a PhD candidate in biochemistry, I think, in Pennsylvania. They're very illustrious. They're not against the United States, but they're very upset about their situation. And so this chapter tries to show how one road can have such different meanings and how strategic the control of a road can be. The next chapter is really fun. I'll tell you about it quickly, and then I will read you a short passage, and I hope you might have some questions for me. The next chapter is about driving in China, which I did with a driving club called the Beijing Target Auto Club. They drive in clubs because, the people I was with were mostly businessmen and their families. Most of them were recently wealthy. They could not have afforded a car 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, anybody who could would not drive themselves. So we took what's called a self-driving tour, because now you can drive yourself. Why not? Why not self-drive? In fact, why not? Wouldn't it be more fun to do with a group of people like you and to together hire a mechanic just in case, because things happen and you go to remote parts of the country and it's, you just don't know who's there. And So there was a mechanic in the front car. Somebody else had arranged for stickers with numbers for everybody's doors. So you knew you were part of a road rally. And there were CB radios so you could see who was ahead of you and who behind. And you could... you could sort of keep score that way. This was you know, what's happening in China is probably of greater environmental significance than what's happening in Peru, and yet there's such exuberance about driving. People there feel that they've been denied cars for years and years. They feel it's been very unfair. They were denied that they had a government that kept them in the dark ages while the rest of you people were out having fun in your cars. They were staying home, and now they're gonna, by God, drive. And so I had a translator, a woman from Beijing, who did not get the driving thing. She said, taxis are fine. You don't need a car. But she good-naturedly, she's a friend of a friend of mine, went along. And there was a day when I just, it was one of the more stressful days of researching this whole book. My driver, Mr. Zhu, loved to pass on the shoulder. And I asked him about that, and he pointed out that it was just as wide as the other two lanes and normally empty. So why not? It's really foolish not to... And a good driver will take advantage of opportunities like that. But driving with him was kind of like being in a video game where you accelerate to 90 and, oh my God, there's a broken down car, brake, and back into the travel lane, and then you round the broken down car, and oh, there's a street sweeper, brake, and back and forth. And I finally said, Lilu, would you ask Mr. Zhu to slow down a little? And she looked at me and was like, are you sure? And then said something to him, and he looked over at me. Nothing changed. And I said, would you tell him that men his age in China have a higher likelihood of dying on the road than men his age anywhere else on Earth? And she really was worried about telling him that. But she did, and then he gave me a look. He didn't say anything, looked ahead, and stepped on it. But I got him back. If you read in here, you'll see how... I was his roommate, and he's a big smoker, and... Uh-oh. That's how I knew he'd woken up in the morning. I'd breathe the smoke. He'd be lying in bed. In fact, at night when he fell asleep, he'd have a cigarette, and I'd have to take it out and put it in the ashtray and find where the remote was under him. And it's not all glamorous, this line of work. But that was a really fun trip. It's kind of like being in a big country where everyone has just turned 16. And and in fact, I then tuck in a little chapter about one of the most fun drives I ever had, which happened to be up Glenwood Canyon before the interstate went in. And it wasn't just that it was a great road, but it's that there was a... I had, in my senior year of high school, I got a job on weekends teaching skiing at Breckenridge, and I'd met a girl from Florida there that I had developed a big crush on, and she and her family were coming back to Aspen for spring break, and my dream was to go there. My Volkswagen... something was wrong with it. It couldn't be driven. My mom's car was not available. At the last minute, my dad, and he'd never done this, he offered me the keys to his Porsche. And my kids' friends in New York City all have bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and this was the closest I ever came, was being handed the key to that car. And I drove... I drove Chinese style really fast up to Aspen at night with the windows down and the radio on. And I don't just want to write about horrific grave issues in this book. It's a book about a lot of life and how it's lived on roads. Okay, so the last chapter is set in Lagos, Nigeria. It's a mega city. It's one of these one of these places where most of the world's people will live in another 10 or 20 years. It has 14 million people now. I think it's projected to have 20 million in between 15 and 20 years. And it's growing so fast, there's no street map you can find that will tell you the names of all the roads there. And they're not planned either. They grow organically. In many cases, they get incredibly congested. The main ones are called highways, but they are congested 24/7. And I thought the best way to put a reader here might be to hang out with an ambulance crew. And it took me a couple weeks to arrange it once I got there, but I did. And the ambulances are often posted at the intersection, so they have a chance of getting to the accident within the same day, basically. The ambulances have two nurses who are always female and a driver called a pilot who's always male. And they're like mobile health clinics. While they're parked, people who need attention come up to them. They get antibiotics. They get shots for malaria. They get all kinds of things. The people who work in the ambulances are really nice people. And in fact, I was scared a few times in Nigeria, but mostly I met just some really wonderful people. And I wanted to just read you a brief passage to give you a taste of the book. This is about it's self-explanatory. Never mind. Just here it is. I didn't know a soul in Lagos. But years earlier, I'd bought some life insurance from a Nigerian in the Bronx. That's where I live. Given the email scams emanating from Nigeria, its reputation for chaos and crime, I knew that might lead friends to question my judgment. But the term life policy, Agbonifo Akpata, touted in a mass mailing, happened to be exactly the one I'd identified through an online broker. And I thought, why not give the commission to an immigrant? What actually could go wrong? So I'd called Akpata, and he had visited our house where I'd signed papers and everything had turned out perfectly. Now that I was Lagos-bound, I tracked him down. He'd left the insurance biz. Of the hundreds or thousands of people he'd approached via postcards to my zip code, he said, I was the only one to actually buy a policy. So he remembered me immediately. He was now trying his hand at real estate brokerage and a bit of property management. But yes, he was from Lagos, and yes, he had friends and family there he would put me in touch with. Agbonifo's second cousin, Biola, was married to Orit Sejolomi Bill Okonedo, and Agbonifo soon enlisted him to meet me at the airport. He also mentioned a man who drove for his brother, an executive with a telephone company in Lagos. I was delighted and relieved because the Lagos airport is an almost mythically awful place, notorious among travelers for shakedowns by officials, and also the only airport on earth about which the U.S. government had seen fit at various times to post signs in American airports alerting travelers that the U.S. Secretary of Transportation has determined that Murtala Muhammad Airport, Lagos, Nigeria, does not maintain and carry out effective airport security measures. I read the phrase again on a special page of my plane ticket and was reminded to pass my arrival information on to Agbonifo so that he could tell Bill. No sooner had I said airport on the phone than Agbonifo told me to make sure I arrived in the morning so that I wouldn't have to drive into the city when it was dark. Bandits prey on cars leaving the airport at night, he warned. But it was already too late. I was set to arrive around dinner time. Should I change my ticket? I asked him. Well, maybe things are better now, he said doubtfully. I'll I'll just condense the next paragraph for you. I was met by two drivers. I was ferried without incident to a working class suburb where Biola and Bill had a two-bedroom apartment, which they insisted I stay in. The apartment was located in Isolo, a working class suburb. The guest... it was on a short street of two-story, multifamily, stucco and cinder block houses that had creaky gates at both ends. Security guards locked them after dark. The house also had a big front gate that was locked at night once Bill's Toyota Starlet was inside. Gates on the doors that were always locked and grills on every window. Bill and Biola had their own small gasoline-powered generator so they could watch television and use lights and a fan at night during the outages in electrical service. The city's electrical grid is a shambles. NEPA, N-E-P-A, the National Electric Power Authority, is also said to stand for Never Expect Power Again. During my stay, electricity in Isola was off about three-quarters of the time. It was noisy with the generator on, but then again, it was often noisy in Isolo anyway. The apartment was small and often very hot, but the couple had given me the larger of their two modest bedrooms, and I felt grateful. Bill was up and out early in the morning. He's a vigorous man in his 50s, a journalist who covers the cyber world for a South African-owned business newspaper. Biola, in her 40s, made him breakfast and then divided her time between tending to the house, taking a history course at a local college, making plans to start a catering business, and attending church functions. Like many Lagosians, she's an evangelical Christian. She belonged to Faith Tabernacle, which I would see is literally the biggest church in the world, capable of holding 50,000 people. She went out to buy fresh food every morning since the refrigerator was seldom cold, and usually she'd cook me an egg with toast for breakfast. And then I would leave for the day, an event that I eventually realized filled her with relief. For as dangerous as it was for me to walk alone on the street in a city where robbery was common, it was risky for them to lodge me. Having a white-skinned tenant was tantamount to saying, "We have a lot of money in here." It happened to be true. Credit cards, traveler's checks, and banking machines are essentially not used in Nigeria, so I brought with me and kept in my room a couple of $1,000s in cash. But I liked living with people. Even nice hotels are so lonely. Bill and B, it seemed, were suspicious of most of their neighbors. They advised me not to speak to others on the street, including the people upstairs, whom they did not socialize with. But they were friends with the neighbors behind. A second two-story house occupied the space in which a backyard would otherwise be, and the ground floor neighbor was a single mom with an inquisitive daughter about 10 years old. Motorola, as she was named, loved... And I asked him, I said, "Is she named after the company?" And he swears, "No, but I think she is." Loved to come in and see what I was doing. I was always glad to show her my things, and she enjoyed telling me what was new with her. Often it was her hair. The girls at her school coordinated the pattern of their braids, changing styles weekly. The day we met, the braids were tied with colorful thin wires and coiled into tiny spirals. The wire was from, you know, those four-wired telephone cables? That's the wire these girls use. I mean, it's a scary place, but how fantastic is that? I describe lots of scenes of attending to people who've had accidents, to dealing with the gang members, the homeless gang members who wander through the congested traffic and take things off of trucks and climb up ladders to where the drivers are and knock on the windows. And some drivers are so scared they give them money to go away, and others punch and stab them. And then they come to the ambulance and the nurses sew them up. There's five police forces involved with traffic. One of them was actually started by Wole Soyinka, the Nobel Prize winning playwright, to protect students at his university. But it grew into another corrupt authority that rips off motorists all day long. And then I end actually with an interview with one of the chiefs of police and with a taxi ride through an intersection that had no electricity. So I'm just going to read you one more very short paragraph here. Each major intersection was thus an exercise in brinksmanship and closely following any car that seemed to have momentum, because the idea of alternating was lost in the volume and lack of well-defined lanes. My driver had nerves of steel and had passed through several chaotic junctions when we came to one that looked relatively uncrowded. It looked as though we'd be able to creep through without even stopping when the lights came back on. And seemingly within a space of 2 or 3 seconds, a policeman stepped into the traffic in front of us, blowing his whistle and pointing accusingly at my driver. He directed us to the side of the road where there were several others in uniform, told the driver to put the car in park, and then reached in and took the keys. The driver prepared to get out to discuss the matter. On his way, he reached above the visor and pulled out ₱1,000. That's about $8.50 note. That happened to equal the agreed-upon fare to the house of the police chief. "It wasn't your fault," I said. "You couldn't have known the light would come on at that second. Don't pay him." The driver nodded and shrugged. "He's got the keys," he said. It was all over but the arguing. The driver hemmed a bit, but I could see his heart wasn't really in it. The money landed in the policeman's palm. Soon the keys were back in the driver's. A different kind of stress lay ahead. The road we were on became a highway, which meant only that it was divided, with maybe 20 feet of dirt separating the two directions. The vehicles in our direction slowed to a crawl. A vestigial median divider disappeared, and as traffic jammed up, cars going our direction, seeking incremental advantage, left the pavement and drove onto the median, filling it up. In other words, our side of the road literally expanded, becoming maybe 6 or 7 vehicles wide. The median was slanted and rutted, but soon we were on it too, inching ahead, looking for an opening, however small. Spaces too tight for a car were soon occupied by motorcycles. These buzzed everywhere, many with customized narrow handlebars to let them squeeze through narrow spaces. I'm talking like this, these motorcycles. For a driver accustomed to obeying lane lines and feeling taken advantage of when somebody zoomed up the shoulder, the situation represented the complete breakdown of order. Here was Hobbes' state of nature, every man out for himself. Of course, it wasn't quite that extreme. A bit of enlightened self-interest kept most drivers from colliding with adjacent cars. But it was close. As I sat in the back of the cab, I felt as though I was in the middle of a giant automotive mosh pit, helplessly part of an aggressive crowd. I then describe a vendor. The roads are full of vendors. This one was dangling rats from a string, which I thought I'd seen everything. And oh my God! I said, "Who would buy dead rats?" They're selling poison, rat poison, he explained between hoots of laughter. "Those dead rats just show how it works. It's advertising." I mean, really. After my interview with the chief and the same taxi back to Bill's, we found ourselves in the same kind of jam. This time my way of coping, as the sides of trucks and buses replaced the view of shanties and billboards, was to imagine an aerial perspective of the mess, a la Google Earth. From above, I could see that the battle for the median strip was in a way a version of the volume control engineered in places like New York's Tappan Zee Bridge. On the Tappan Zee, custom vehicles known as zipper machines move a line of concrete dividers from one side of the roadway to the other, depending on which direction has the heaviest traffic. Similar systems are in place in Honolulu, Dallas, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Ontario, and Auckland, New Zealand. San Diego, too? In Lagos, you could argue the same thing seems to happen, but without the intervention of traffic engineers. In my mind, I kept rising so that I could see for blocks and blocks. I could imagine the yellow of the buses and taxis standing out against the gloomy gray of almost everything else. The other specks of color I conjured up were the pinks, greens, oranges, and reds of women's traditional robes. I could visualize the evangelist billboards, "Lord, let us tell good from evil so that we do not die of the unexpected." And signs like the one after which I named this chapter, "Drive soft, life no get duplicate." That's good. The billboards beckoning men and women to lives of more of purpose and moral conduct. Evangelical Christianity and populist Islam were the fastest growing religions here, and they were of a piece with the worldly grime and grit. They offered a path to higher ground, a spiritual elevation from the omnipresent squalor and constant threat of scam. Higher yet, I could picture the boundaries of Lagos, those edges where a creeping urban settlement met with field and forest. Roads connected the megacity to smaller ones, but this megacity was hardly alone. Lagos is, quote, simply the biggest node in the shanty town corridor of 70 million people that stretches from Abidjan to Ibadan, as Mike Davis has observed. At night, from space, you'd be able to see an amazing band of lights across the coast of West Africa, at least if the power was on. So thank you. And did I already thank the Tattered Cover? I've had signings for each of my books at the Tattered Cover. It's been one of the joys of my life to come back here, and I am so glad you are still here. Really, really am.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.